Hello and welcome to Origins, the programme that asks musicians, artists, writers and creators where it began, how it evolved and where it's at. In this episode, Andrew Payne meets Sam Potter of Late of the Pier, the Sea Change Festival in Totnes, where he's performing the music of February Montaigne.
I guess when you're from a village, you really want to leave the village, and you fantasize about different ways of doing so. And being in a band is one of the most exotic ways of doing it. And I mean, the East Midlands isn't famous for its bands. There's people like Tindersticks, I guess, and the guy who did Your Woman, White Town, was from Derby. But there's something quite preposterous about it. And the band I was in, Late of the Pier, we all came from the same village, and we used to kind of walk through the wreckage of the old power station that was knocked down a few years before, and we very much projected our imaginations onto the music we made, and it was quite lofty teenage music. So I guess it was quite a natural thing to do.
How old were you when the band started? You just mentioned you were a teenager, so...
Yeah, so about like 16, 17. Yeah.
And, I mean, we'll talk about February in a little while, but did you literally start making music in bedrooms with your friends? Is that how it all began?
Yeah, absolutely. It's my friend Sam who's the genius behind it. He inherited a load of old analog synths from his dad, and it was very much a bedroom thing, yeah. Used to be in his loft, and like I was saying with listening to The Prodigy before, we used to do a similar thing where we'd turn the lights off and try and imagine what it would sound like for a big club PA and dance around and think, no, we need to be dancing a bit longer with this bit.
And how did you make the move from the bedroom out to the big wide world?
Just playing shows. Did the bass player's sister's birthday party, and then we played in a town called Loughborough. We played in a biker bar in Colville once. And Colville is every bit the ex minor town it sounds like. And then playing in Nottingham, and just meeting some fellow freaks, I guess, and from there finding a sound and finding acceptance and being strange and weird, and yeah, it came full circle. Yeah, it's a nice feeling when you strive to leave a village and you manage to do so. Yeah.
So what did you learn most then from that experience with Late of the Pier?
I guess it's just the capital of being individual and striving to do something that's unique. It's definitely something I've took all the way through my life, maybe trying to be different a little too hard sometimes, but now I'm 32, I'm thankful for those teenage years where you do really push it and you do really try too hard to do something new.
And so when did the band fold? Is that the right word? Because you all sort of went off in slightly different.
Yeah, it kind of evaporated. It was really, yeah, just a slow kind of curve into nothingness. There was the book that I wrote last year that the lead singer Sam did. He did the images for. And he kind of chipped in a bit on the science. We did the reissue last year. Yeah, so we've kind of evaporated. We were in some strange gaseous state, I guess. Yeah, the atoms are still there. It's just whether they go next to each other and form into a solid again.
Science.
What an abomination. Innocence is such a crime. Hard work and sound and vision to bring you the beast in time.
They kind of came back as a solid for the book, yeah. Which I'm going to ask you to deliver the title for. I've got it written down here,
yeah.
But I can't remember it off the top of my head. So the book was called...
It's called Ecstatic Datasets, the Chorismos Apeiron Scanner.
Exactly, it just trips off the tongue, that one, doesn't it?
It really does, yeah.
Would you be able to summarise that book in a few sentences for us?
It's a handbook for a speculative machine that uses sound to help the user navigate their emotional landscape.
And it's a work of fiction?
It's a work of speculative fiction. So I wrote it as something I wanted to come true, but might not. It's a love letter to music, basically. And all the technology... It exists in very nascent forms. It's existing as the great big IBM computer in a huge room, and I'm hoping in 30 years' time it gets shrunk down into an iPhone size. And
wonderful thing about writing that kind of fiction, I was talking to a friend of mine, David Keenan. We were talking about his last book, this memorial device, where there's a fictional Airdrie. And all these bands who live in and play in Airdrie. And one of the bands is called Chinese Moon, which essentially are three mannequins. And he was talking about conjuring these images. But after the book was written, Chinese Moon did actually put a track out.
Ah.
And Chinese Moon were... They became a physical entity. So and we were talking about conjuring and writing being this magic.
I wondered if
you've perhaps put this out into the world, you've conjured something up that might come to pass.
Well, the exciting thing is that it's going to happen. I'm doing a residency in Portland in October, and we're building a prototype of this very lofty machine, kind of. Well, one of the ladies who inspired the machine is called Dr. Kelly Snook. She was at the panel at the Science Museum, and she's a NASA scientist who just has a deep love of the complexity and beauty of the universe. And yeah, she's managed to get some funding, and she's bringing a team of clever people out to Portland, and I'm gonna go there as the lay not clever person, and we're gonna make an instrument out of the solar system.
That's quite a statement. Make an instrument out of the solar system.
Yeah, so it's based on this idea called data sonification. So music is essentially maths. It's a series of data points. So if you think like that, it means you can extrapolate any amount of information, data. It could be a maths equation. It could be comparing... comparing moons that go around different planets and extrapolating the commonalities. Could be the amount of frogs in a particular square of field in Australia. And you can take that data, transpose it into a musical system, and then play the frogs in the field. Yeah. And it's based on the thinking of Johann Kepler,
right,
who towards the end of his life was so impressed with the symmetry and the beauty of the mathematics of the solar system that he started writing his theories out in musical score. And he wrote a book called The Harmony of the Spheres. And yeah, we're kind of doing this as a celebration of Kepler's work.
Okay. So how will this manifest itself?
God knows. I really don't know. I think I've never been involved in any prototyping before. What I'm doing is I'm writing a kind of speculative fiction for what it could be, and I've got some musicians together, and we're going to do a performance in a planetarium using the instrument and presenting it as a maybe like a kind of investigative art society 100 years in the future.
I like that. And where the planetarium will be, will this be in Portland?
It will, yeah.
Is your hope that it will then perhaps come over here?
Yeah,
or will this be very much a one-off?
Well, hopefully the prototyping goes well and we can keep building on it, and then we can sell them all around the world, and young children in Beijing or Reykjavik can be playing the universe.
The idea of playing the universe. And that sort of links me to February, because it's February Montaigne, isn't it? Mm. That's his full name. Because when I was reading some of the interviews, there's a quote in there where he talks about music as sophisticated emotional technology.
Mm.
And I wondered if, in working on February's music, that led you or inspired you to write the pamphlet.
Yeah, well, there's a quote he has. What's the quote he says? It's saying that great music listens to you in the same way you listen to it. And if you have this feedback between a music and yourself, like say you're really touched by a Chopin piece or, I don't know, like a Fugazi piece, I don't know. And it does something to your soul, and you find this corner of yourself that you've never properly been with before, and suddenly you're more aware of who you are. And if great music can do that, I kind of read this and I was like, I think technology could kind of cheat that. If you have these systems that are listening to your body and taking these pieces of information and making a psychographic image of who you are, what if a music has access to this kind of technology? In the same way, what would Andy Warhol do if he worked for Cambridge Analytica? I mean, essentially what we're talking about is understanding those parts of what it is to be human in a new way, and the technology is being developed, there's lots of money. Obviously it's going to be a very lucrative discovery to understand what it is to be human. It's what artists have done for all time. And if you can make an art that is then responsive to that, then you're halfway to having incredibly effective art that can do more than entertain them.
Do you think, I'm kind of shooting in the dark here, but do you think that kind of art perhaps takes away any kind of sense of emergence or accident? If the technology is doing all the work for us,
yeah,
and is second guessing, does that not take away the stumbling upon? I mean, when I was younger, I know everyone quotes this, but in my case, it really is true. I used to watch this program called Lift Off with Aisha. I'm much older than you, so there's no way you'd remember it. It was on ITV. And that was where I saw Bowie do Starman. There was a video, and it was like, I don't know who you are. I don't even know if you're a boy or a girl.
Mm.
I don't know anything about it, but you look great, and that song's amazing.
Mm.
And then I had to wait until it came onto the radio, or maybe it was on Top of the Pops again, for me to find out who that was.
Yeah.
But that really was quite a turning point for me musically.
Mm.
But I stumbled on it. So if yeah. there is, and I know there, I was watching it on television, so obviously the technology was there in a very kind of archaic form. But are we not talking about something that's going to kind of read me and present something to me?
Hmm.
And take away perhaps the happenstance that I had.
I mean, it's all very speculative.
Yeah.
But it could be aware that you like everyone else enjoy surprise, and you enjoy the feeling of emergence. Like the way we're delivered culture is sometimes just as important as the actual content itself. I mean, when we listen to music, it's not just air vibrating in our ears and becoming sound, it's the whole image around it. So if this algorithm is aware that you are like that, it could be boring you at points. It could be putting you in a state where you're just not conscious that something amazing is going to happen, and then it's going to hit you. It's going to understand your surprise systems, and it's going to pounce on you when you least expect it.
When, just to go back to the music that you were listening to, when, what was the last piece of music that surprised you, that pounced on you, took you by storm?
I've been listening to this guy called John Luther Adams, who's a really amazing composer. He went to some fancy conservatoire in LA, lived there until he was about 30, and was just kind of like milling around, doing the odd kind of soundtrack, I think, and not being happy. And then he moved to Alaska. And you're talking about emergence. I first heard this story before I heard his music. And he moved to Alaska, and him and his friend were walking over the tundra. And they see this white distance, the white thing in the distance. And they're not sure if it's a 20-foot obelisk or if it's a tiny ball. And they walk towards it. And they keep walking, and it keeps staying the same distance away from them. And they're walking for an hour, still there. They walk for 2 hours, and they walk for 3 hours. And they come up to it, and they realize it's a white bird, a white owl. And it looks at them, and then flies away. And he says, that to me is music. And I was like, this is going to be really good. And I have a room in my house where there's no windows, and I have a bed in there, and it's really nice for meditating and just generally just calming down. And I had this on the stereo, this piece of music called Become Ocean. And it's a very textural piece. It's very kind of like shimmying. I think it's a 60-piece orchestra, and you can feel the ripples going through. It's the closest piece of music I've ever heard to nature. It's really big and swelling and brooding, and it keeps moving, and you're in this kind of interzone. You're kind of awake, you're in this liminal space, and you're kind of asleep, and it surges towards the end, and these great big horns come in, and yeah, I was so moved. I haven't been that moved by a piece of music in an awful long time. And it didn't sound like anything I'd ever heard.
Those are the great moments, aren't they? When you find something, you find something like that, and it completely blows you away.
Actually saw it played by a live orchestra in Leipzig last year, and I cried. I never cry at films, I never cry at gigs or music, and I was crying. It put some very strange thoughts in my head. I was thinking about my last hours of life.
Really?
Really. It really did something to me. That is sophisticated emotional technology at its highest and strongest, I guess.
Tell me a little bit about February Montaigne and how you came to discover and start working on his music.
Yeah, so the two questions are the same question, really. I grew up in a village that was quite close to a little place called Aston-on-Trent, so it's literally just over the Trent. There's a point you can see called King's Mills where they used to print money. You look over the river, and that's Aston-on-Trent, but it takes about 20 minutes to drive there. And I got an email, it must have been like 5 years ago, from a girl called Susie saying, I was a fan of your band, my stepdad left this music, can you have a listen and give me any advice? And I open up the attachment, I press play, and I was just gone. It's amazing. You're talking about emergence and delivery of culture. Like I wasn't expecting anything whatsoever. people's stepdads don't generally make good music in the East Midlands. So I was like, have you got any more? She sent me another one and she says, that's it for now. I was like, come on, you can't tease me. And it's a super tease. And yeah, so she says there's more in these boxes. You should come and check it out, and she come help me get it on the computer. And I went, and it was just this big box full of maybe like 50, 60 tapes or something, and all these notebooks. There was old pictures. And I was like, this is treasure. As a musician, and I guess even more as a music listener, you don't usually get such an interesting journey into sound. It's usually for a blog you like, or a friend, or a recommendation. And this was just music that hardly anyone had ever heard before. And when you play the tapes, you hear a guy who just made music in his bedroom. I get the idea that he never wanted it released, which has been a little bit hard to square. But it's very, yeah, it's just very honest, very authentic, very moving music from someone I'm never going to meet. And I had to finish off quite a few songs, like a lot of really sketchy demos. I did quite a lot of mixing to make sure it sounded okay. But the whole time I'm kind of consulting his ex-wife, Amelia, and she's telling me off for doing it wrong and giving me very cryptic kind of notes on the best sound to have, and taking the writing and publishing some of the writing. And yeah, it's been a real trip.
So what was he using to record on? Was he literally just turning a tape recorder
on?
I
really don't know, because as far as I know, the box is all that was left. So there's no musical equipment. Despite him writing such extensive notes, he never really wrote about his own process. He never wrote about the equipment he was using or how he got his sounds. I mean, it's quite simple music. Like, there's nothing too clever about it, but still there's certain sounds and techniques that you really wonder how on earth he did it. It's an interesting thing to talk about, because there's so many blank spots in his life and who he was and how he did things. And the only way I know about February is through what he left, and through Amelia and what she cares to tell me, which is sometimes not a lot. Yeah.
So what? I'm really interested in someone who wrote and performed music in their bedroom, essentially, with no purpose other than to create and make music for themselves, which I guess is the best way to make art anyway. It's just to do it for yourself.
I think that's the thing. I think we have an idea of amateurness that is not necessarily right. I think if you're an amateur is an impassioned hobbyist, I guess. It's somebody who's spending time, and if that hobby and that pursuit is something as personal as making music, this abstract form which tends to do very wiggly, strange things to our brains and our heartstrings, then when you hear an amateur musician by himself in his bedroom not wanting to release music and show people or play live, you get this human connection that's kind of akin to nothing. I don't think, obviously it's a very subjective thing, but I don't think any other art form kind of touches it. And it is in the abstract nature of it that its beauty and its complexity kind of unfold. And nice, he's got a nude. Yeah. Oh, on cue.
Oh, this is good.
Yeah.
Nice soundtrack.
So what was it about listening to that first or the second song that you got sent? Was it the space in between the music that sold you? Or was it the completeness of the song that sold? What made you think, oh, I want to pursue this, I want to do something with this?
I don't know. Music doesn't give us all its workings. Sometimes it just did something. And I think making music myself, I was in a little bit of a rut at the time. It's kind of losing my passion for it a little bit. I was getting quite disillusioned with the way we consume music and how it's so throwaway. And I guess February was my invitation back into this lovely, deep, woozy world.
And this was the deep, woozy world of about 1985 to 91, is that right?
Yeah, so he disappeared in 91. The 85 bit is maybe too early still, just because the sound of the recordings. Looking at the tapes as well, I was on the internet, like there's a website you can look at how old the cassettes are. And like the oldest one was 1985, so took a kind of guess there.
There's something quite romantic about it as well, because when I saw some of the photographs, I'm still quite a fan of the cassette. I think it's a beautiful piece of, it's just a lovely design.
They sound great as well. The way they compress sound, they really hug the mix. They really wrap their arms around it and make it complete, I guess.
Yeah, I still record with a four-track Tascam cassette recorder.
Yeah, great, yeah.
And there is something nice, lovely and warm and woozy about it. Oh, that's good. Mm. But if it had just been a photograph of some cassettes, I would have thought, that's cool. But it was the fact that it came with these photographs and these notebooks as well. So did you find that you had to sort of try and get into February's mindset?
Very much. Especially with Amelia there at the end of the production line, kind of surveying everything and knowing February and knowing his motivations. And I had to become possessed. I had to become obsessed. I had to think like he did and make his choices. Otherwise, Amelia just sends me back and I have to go again. So it was a very strange, quite an eerie process of trying to understand somebody I'd never met, trying to think as he would and be in his shoes and take on his spirit and bring his ghost into manifest life and wear his suit, I guess.
How has that transcended into the live experience? Because I know that you've performed these songs live.
Well, I mean, even more so, it's a difference between Sam Potter playing a cover show. I mean, did an interview the other day and says we're probably the eeriest cover band in Europe right now. But if I really feel it and I really have something under my skin and the music moves me and the crowd feel it too, I do become February Montaigne. Yeah.
And what do you think, the spirit of February, what do you think he might think watching you perform these songs? What would your hope be?
I mean, if he didn't like it, he might do something. And we shouldn't laugh, but it's sometimes tempting. It's kind of, how do you provoke a ghost? How do you get him to be with you? From his notes, I feel a real kinship with the way he sees the world. Maybe because I've been with him for 5 years and I've took his quote, I've made a book. That book has turned into like work I've been doing. That there is a degree of kind of manifestation happening, and there is a kind of meeting in the middle between me and this character. So I hope he's not angry. I mean,
I hope not.
It would be a very strange thing if you died and went to heaven and you look down and you see your kind of legacy being acted out by some young whippersnapper. And he's finishing your songs and he's turning your quotes into books. And what would you do? I mean, do you smite them? Do you smile? Is it is it a compliment? Is it me just being a chancer? I'm not too sure.
I mean, there's something beautifully serendipitous about all of this, and I do think it's a little bit like tuning in to a radio station, isn't it? You just have to open your mind and go through the dial until you sort of hear the thing that really comes through.
Yeah, very much so.
Strongly.
Yeah. And I think that's true of life as well. That's where our sense of self comes from. It's this constant tuning. It's going for events and landing on a radio station and feeling that you, for a brief moment, understand what it is to be you. I'm just using February as a kind of weird guide.
Trying to wear my clothes, trying to wear my skin, but it's late, early in the day, nobody's drunk.
And where is that taking you now? I mean, obviously you're still working through these songs and you're performing them live.
Yeah.
But has it taken you to a next step? What are you working on?
Yeah, so like since doing these interviews, I've had some of February's old friends come forwards, and there's one piece in particular which is really exciting, and I'm still trying to understand how best to present it to the world or to believe it. I think a lot of what February did wasn't real whatsoever. I think he wrote these things down and he wrote them as if they're happening, but I think it was all just like a flight of fancy. But this one notebook, it contains this idea for, he called it the chapter, and essentially it's an arts fund, an arts kind of board, like many different layers where they try to understand the world they live in, and they try to understand the human. And through understanding those two things, they then present these experiments. And it, to me, it kind of feels like what art colleges should be, or what the Ministry of Culture should be. And once you square these two things, once you understand your environment and you understand ways of communicating amazing, beautiful things about the planet we live, and you find a way of angling them into the human experience in such a way, you have incredible art that does more than just entertainment. It gives people a sense of kind of empathy with the world they're in and their fellow humans. And yeah, so I'm still to show the world this thing. I think maybe the best way of me doing it is just taking his notes and just publishing them, and rather than me trying to channel anything with it, I should just give it the world and see what the world does with it.
When might we expect to see this?
I should probably do it straight after this interview. I should probably just do it. I've been dilly-dallying a little bit. I showed them to my friend Dr. Kelly Snook, and just so happens she's setting up an investigative arts organization as well with her friend. And we're talking a lot about Greta Thunberg and how we have this global warming issue that has been an issue for an awful long time, and we've known it's been an issue. And there's been so many different ways of trying to communicate this, and there being no traction. And then this very sweet, grumpy Scandinavian teenager comes along, and then the world springs into action. And what we have there is we have information. The world is fucked. We're fucking it. And then you communicate that for a sweet girl, and then suddenly it makes sense and people have sprung to action. And that's kind of what art is and what art should be. Art is communication. So Yeah, so between Kelly and her friend and February's book, hopefully there'll be a very strange document coming into the world quite soon.
I do love this idea. Essentially, you've just opened a space, haven't you? And you've kind of followed where your passion's taken you. In all this conversation, the 36 minutes we've spent talking to each other, you've described yourself as a chancer or the layman going over to spend time with a group of experts.
Yeah.
It's just that lovely openness to just making connections with other people.
I think that's kind of what an artist is. And an artist is, I mean, they're not really experts in any mode of thinking.
And you don't have to be an expert, do you?
You just have to
have a passion. You just want to open the conversation.
You follow your nose, and there's so much to be curious about in the world. And we're at a very strange juncture. Speaking yesterday on a panel about making art for the sentient beings of the future, I see that as a nice way of looking at things. I'm finding these things I'm interested about. I'm putting these things in the world to kind of put a marker in time, and then internet historians of the future can see these things and hopefully get a picture of what it is to be a human in 2019.
Bottom line, but yet I'm doing fine. You can dream and you can float and you can go wherever you go, and you can dream and you can float and you can go.
To keep up to date with Sam's work, follow @LOTPOfficial on Instagram.